Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And this week we're talking about vampires. Specifically, we're talking about vampire bats. But I feel like I have to urge everyone, like, don't run away. Because,
no.
Because on one hand, vampires, of course, as just in as a whole, like bringing in all the various fantasy elements there, like that's completely overblown to the point that most people, I think, are getting, if not completely already, bored with vampires. You know, we kind of know what to expect with it. And then with vampire bats, I don't want to, you know, discredit them either, but on the, at a surface level, it's easy to say, oh, well, they're bats and they drink blood from cows. No big deal. I've seen Attenborough talk about them on documentaries. And yes, they're neat, but I don't necessarily need to hear about them for an hour. But the thing is, when you really start asking questions about the blood diet and about the vampiric lifestyle and how that evolved,
yeah,
you really get into some crazy imaginative areas that really blew my mind.
Yeah, these guys are so interesting for many, many reasons. And we've talked about bats. I think we had a couple of bat episodes last year, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about how, we'll discuss a little bit about this, but we've talked about how they have rich social bonds and, they are amazing creatures, and they have these forelimbs. If you look at their bodies, it's very easy to see the human hand and the human arm bones, replicated in that wingspan. That alone gives us this idea that there's so much to this mammal, this only flying mammal, that relates to us. And then there's the weirdness of the blood diet, too. So let's launch into these guys, because they're so amazing.
Yeah, vampire bats. Now, bats exist in various places throughout the world. We have both the Old World and the New World bats.
Yeah.
New World, of course, being the Americas. But out of all these species, and we're talking over 1,000, like 1,105 more or less different species of bats in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They make up a quarter of all mammal species. And yet, vampire bats, limited to 3 species currently. All 3 live in the New World, in the Americas, ranging from Mexico to Brazil, Chile, and Argentina.
And there's a reason for that.
Yes.
We'll get into that in a little bit. But when we're talking about these 3 species we are talking about, Desmodus rotundus, Diphyllia ichodata, and Daimus jungi. And respectively, we were talking about the common vampire, the hairy-legged vampire, and the white-winged vampire.
Yes, and these are all three, again, they're vampires. They're sanguivores. They live, which, and they're obligate sanguivores, meaning they live exclusively on blood.
They are obligated to drink it,
right,
or they will die.
It's not just a situation of like, yeah, I eat blood, eat bugs, and then I get a little blood here and there. No, they exist solely on blood. And as we'll discuss, like, that's a hard road. Like, blood is not a great nutrient. Like, if you had to choose one thing in the world to live upon,
right,
that's not a good choice. Like, that's why you have, that's really one of the reasons you have only three species out of these thousands of species of bats that do this. The rest are living on fruits or insects. And then here are these guys and gals, and they're depending upon blood.
Yeah, in a pretty limited region if you look at it from a world perspective. But let's look at the way these guys appear to us, because they're quite striking. They have these pig-like noses that, if you ever look at Angry Birds and you see the pigs,
mm-hmm,
they've got big gizmo ears.
Yes.
Right? And they have a kind of a, it's been described as a cleft on its chin, which helps to channel the blood.
Yes.
And then, of course, these just razor sharp teeth.
Yeah, and the nose that you mentioned is all, they also have this this kind of nose leafing, it's called,
mm-hmm,
which almost kind of makes their nose look like some sort of a fungus. And you find these all in other bats as well, not just the vampire bats, but they give the vampire bat a very distinct appearance. And in fact, early naturalists thought, you know, I guess based mostly on illustrations at this point, that those leaves might be sharp. So their noses are kind of these razor blades that they might be using to slice open their prey in order to drink the blood, which isn't so. The nose leaves have to do with echolocation and, mm-hmm, also thermolocation.
Yeah.
Not only seeing things with sight, but also detecting changes in temperature so they can see where that blood is, see where to strike and where to drink.
Exactly. They actually, it's sort of like an infrared system that can actually sense that heat. But what I love about the way they look and these depictions of them is they almost look like these fictional, like, medieval etchings or something, or something, mm-hmm, that would come out of the mind of man, because,
yeah,
they look so bizarre.
They do. They have this goblin-y look to them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you look at illustrations of fantastic goblins and whatnot, mm-hmm, and monsters and demons, and then you look at the bat, and then you have to wonder, well, what comes first, you know? To what extent has the bat influenced our iconography of the,
yeah,
monstrous? To,
yeah,
what extent has the monstrous interpreted our interpretation of the bat? Because, for instance, the vampire thing, it's really, our understanding of the vampire bat is fairly recent. And again, they're in the New World. They're in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the vampire, of some sort of creature that sustains itself on blood, on human blood especially, like, that's a very old idea that you find, back in, even in the Hellenistic ages, and perhaps, even earlier.
Indeed, but let's get into some of their feeding habits.
Yes.
Because this is really interesting stuff. In a study published in the journal BMC Biology, it was found that vampire bats of the species Desmodus rotundus, by the way, they were named rotundus at the time because their stomachs appeared to the people as very, very large to the researchers.
Mm-hmm.
But little did they know that the stomach was actually filled with blood at that moment, so that's why the stomach looked so rotund. But they found that these bats could recognize recorded human breathing sounds much better than human participants could. And vampire bats feed on the same prey, by the way, over several nights. And the authors of the study proposed that the bats use breathing sounds to identify prey in the same way humans use voice to recognize each other. So it's interesting not only that they have the certain livestock in mind, but they can differentiate between that livestock based on their breathing patterns.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this ability with bats before, this sort of zen-like ability just to take everything else in the background and have it sort of recede and really hone in on the prey.
Yeah, they're amazing creatures. And it's easy to focus on all of this, the alien aspects of the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we discussed in a previous podcast, it's almost impossible to put ourselves in that perspective and to imagine seeing the world as the bat sees the world.
Yeah.
But they're also really social creatures. They typically gather in colonies of about 100 animals, but sometimes they may live in a group of 1,000 or more. And, incidentally, over that time, a 100 bat colony can drink, the blood of 25 cows. But, But again, they're very social. You see actual reciprocal altruism in vampire bats. Mm-hmm. You see, because as we'll discuss, it's essential with a blood diet to get that blood every night if possible. And if you go 48 hours without blood as a vampire bat, you're starving.
Yeah, you're toast.
Yeah, and so we see examples of the vampire bats bringing blood back and feeding the famished bats, the bats that haven't had enough to eat, and looking after each other in this fashion. And that one of the theories here with this is that bats picked up this behavior, this kind of altruism, this mm-hmm. looking after one another, because in their habitats, as you see the horse die away, as you see the camel and the giant sloth disappear from the continent, mm-hmm. leaving them only much more limited food supplies, they had to do this in order to survive.
Yeah, there's a kind of cooperation just like among humans, right?
Right.
If you kind of help me out this time, I'll help you out next time. You know, you can't find a source of blood.
Right.
That's what I said yesterday to you, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and there's some degree of argument in this particular topic among bat researchers, but they may be able to weed out cheats. So if you're taking blood but not giving, mm-hmm. then they're going to cut you off.
Ah, that's interesting. And they have seen that in captivity, all of the bats will share a meal if someone needs it. But in their natural habitat, the adult males will not engage in this behavior.
Hmm.
The females will, of course.
Interesting.
They also like to sniff each other as a greeting.
Oh, good.
And they perform social grooming of one another.
Which is key. We'll be getting back to that in a minute.
Yeah. And for their body size, vampire bats have one of the largest brains among bats. The neocortex is about twice the average size of other bats. And as we know about the neocortex in humans, it's really important in terms of social intelligence and social complexity. So it would make sense that it is so very large and that they have these very rich bonds with one another. And we have talked about this before in the other podcast about bats, but a lot of this has to do with their communication, which is super nuanced.
Yes.
We know, of course, they can recognize each other's voices. We also know that bats share a common gene for communication called FOXP2 with us. And we also know, according to researcher Mirjam Kornschild and her colleagues at the University of Erlangen, Nuremberg, in Germany, that the younger greater sac bats, the baby ones, were observed stringing together screeches, barks, and hisses with no social context, essentially practicing language, much like a toddler does when it babbles.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, you see a lot of parallels with humans.
All right. So let's talk about evolution. Now, mostly we're interested in the evolution of vampirism, of depending upon that blood diet. But let's step it out a little more and think about the evolution of the bat itself. Bats and birds, obviously they have a great deal in common.
Mm-hmm.
Both are flying organisms, yet they're very different. In birds, we have the avians emerging about 150 million years ago during the Jurassic period. And they go on from there to fly, swim, trot, and burrow all over the world. Meanwhile, the mammalian bat dates back between 75 and 100 million years ago, but it's hard to say because even though they're one of the most diverse groups of mammals today, they're one of the least common groups in the fossil records. Part of this is that they have small, light skeletons. They don't preserve all that well. And also, if you're residing in a tropical environment, as a lot of these bats do today and did historically, these are not environments where dead things last long.
Yeah, the rate of decomposition is much
things
greater.
It's breaking down. It's hot. It's moist. Things are eating. So it's the chances of fossilization are reduced. Again, there are over 1,000 different species of bats in the world. They make up a quarter of all mammal species. And among these, we have the megabats, as opposed to the microbats. These are the large bats found in the Old World tropical rainforests, Australia, Asia, and Africa. The biggest bat in the world is the Malayan flying fox found in Asia. It weighs about 2 pounds and has a wingspan span of about 6 feet. And that's one of the fruit eaters. The smallest bat in the world is Kitty's hognose bat, also called the bumblebee bat. And that's found in Thailand and weighs about 2 grams. It's about as much as a dime, by the way. And it has a 6-inch wingspan. So both the bat and the bird learn to fly in their own way. And there are other fascinating examples of their convergent evolution. Several dozen bat species and more than 300 species of hummingbird evolved to resemble each other, both anatomically and behaviorally, solely because they existed in similar environments and exploited a similar resource. Namely, nectar. All right, this is the sugary, liquid bribe of pollen-producing plants. But those are the nectivores. And we're here to talk about bats with another highly specialized lifestyle for a liquid diet. And we're talking here, of course, about the sanguivores, the blood drinkers. How did the blood drinkers evolve?
Well, the first vampire bats emerged less than 26 million years ago, according to genetic evidence. And they are closely related to insect-eating bats that may have gorged on the parasites of prehistoric beasts. So if you've just feasted on a fat, juicy tick, let's say, then it's not too far of a walk in logic to see how some bats may have begun to have the taste for blood or to seek it out as a main source.
Right. And we see this to a certain degree in birds. There are birds that occasionally or even frequently feed on blood. Vampire finches of the Galapagos Islands occasionally feed by drinking the blood of other birds. Meanwhile, there are plenty of birds that feed on ticks and other ectoparasites on large animals, you know, oxpeckers and the like. They're eating the ticks, they're eating the fleas, whatever. And then if there's a little blood there from the host organism, they'll go ahead and cross that line and have some of it as well. But there's little or no convergence between birds and bats when it comes to blood. When we're talking about obligate blood drinking, you don't see any obligate blood drinking birds, which is...
Thank goodness.
Well, yeah, thank
imagine
goodness.
The pigeons out there.
Yeah.
So central are these blood meals to vampire bats that they actually have been messing around or modifying a plasminogen activator gene, which we have, you know, humans have it, and it protects against heart attack by producing proteins that bust up blood clots and they clear vessels. But they actually have this, this gene that they can activate in their saliva. And David Liberles, a geneticist at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, studied three species of vampire bats and found this modification. And he found that two species that prey on livestock acquired additional mutations that prevent these PA proteins from being silenced by a natural inhibitor. So he says that's a process that humans and other mammals use to put a harness on blood clotting, but feeding on mammals, he says, is a key adaptation for bats. So it's just further evidence that this is so important to them, that they've been tinkering over time with their genes to say, hey, we need to make this process more solid.
Yeah, like at a genetic level, they are completely committed to this blood diet. And we're going to get into some more aspects of this a little more, but it's such a specialized diet that it demands a very specialized physiology.
Exactly.
Like it's not, and that's something to keep in mind again when you think of humanoid vampires. Like what would it take for a human? Could a human live on blood exclusively? No, a human couldn't. It would require a different species of humanoid.
Exactly.
Entirely.
Yeah, you'd have to be a very tiny humanoid, first of all. But I did want a little side note here. Mention that the anticoagulating enzyme that they produce has been synthesized by researchers, and it is called Draculin.
Nice.
Isn't that nice? And it's used in medication for stroke victims to keep tissue damage at a minimum by keeping that blood flow to those tissues.
Yeah, like we discussed when we were talking about leeches, I believe. Any animal that depends on blood has to be kind of a hacker. And the bat, though, it's hard to call a bat a parasite. You see people shying away from them and that and calling them a carnivore. But still, they have to be able to hack the blood. And so, from a medical standpoint, as we try to figure out ways to hack the blood, we end up turning to the leeches, to the bats, to the parasites of the world, to the blood drinkers of the world and see how they do it. You mentioned the evolution of the bat and the idea that they evolved from insect-eating bats in prehistory. And I just wanted to run through that idea.
Because it gave you some visuals, didn't it?
It did. And specifically, I was reading a fantastic book, and you were reading this as well, by Bill Shute called Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. It's available on paperback, hardcover, and Kindle, and it's really excellent. Excellently written, great for just about any reading level, any science level. But he really goes into this topic, and I really enjoyed it so much I wanted to hit the three or so hypotheses that he mentions. Now, the first hypothesis is, again, we have these proto-vampire bats, And they're feeding on blood engorged ectoparasites found on large prehistoric animals. So mm-hmm. think of all those crazy prehistoric animals that we covered in the past or you've seen pictures of. And they're of course, loaded with parasites. Big old ticks, big old fleas, other things that are
it's
gorging on the blood. Yeah, it's a feast. And you're a bat. You eat insects. And it's a world in which the insects are the available prey. And here's a large animal and it's crawling with these things. So, You're gonna eat those, right? You're gonna eat those big blood-gorged ticks and whatnot. And so the idea here is that they're dining on those and over time they cross the line. They start drinking some blood from the host and then they reach the point where they're living exclusively on the blood of the host animal and ignoring all of those, ticks and fleas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is supported by the fact, as a hypothesis, that 70% of bats are insectivores, so we know that prehistoric bats would have been eating insects. And there are anecdotal reports of vampire bats preying on vampire moths. Now, just, that's going to come as a surprise for a lot of you because, yes, there is a vampire moth.
Blood on blood here.
Yeah, and you'll find them in Malaysia. You'll find them in
Thailand.
Ural, Southern Europe. And so, there's anecdotal evidence that vampire bats have preyed on blood-engorged insects. So, take that for what it's worth.
Another scenario that lends support to this idea is the whole grooming thing, right? Because mm-hmm. you had pointed that out. That's important socially that you sit there and groom each other. So that would be an opportunity to pick out some nice juicy morsels, right? That could lend some support to it. And I said that it was a sort of short walk in logic to say you would cross over, but that's also a little simplistic, right? Because that's like saying that if you had to be a cannibal in this very dire situation as a human being, mm-hmm. that once you had that, you might go cannibal for the rest of your life, right?
Right. Yeah. We find it increasingly when you try and apply some sort of mathematical model for evolution, you fall into this trap. Because it's not a situation of, well, X plus Y equals Z here, so it must be the same here, and it gets complex. Anyway, bat expert Brock Fenton disagrees with this theory that we've been discussing, and he argues on this on 3 points. Number one, ectoparasites are small. Like, even if we're talking about a prehistoric animal,
mm-hmm.
it's still going to have small parasites. It's not like the giant elephant had giant ticks necessarily.
So it has to take like thousands of these things.
Yeah, you're
to
still
get
having to eat
blood.
A lot of them, and it's going to be difficult to ectoparasites are difficult to find on other animals, and vampire bats are restricted to a very slim portion of the Americas. And so part of his argument is, if this was really how things were going to go down, why didn't it go down like this in other places? So mm-hmm. he presents hypothesis number two, the idea that proto-vampire bats fed on insects and larvae crawling around the gaping wounds of large prehistoric mammals. So, which is another wondrously grotesque image to imagine a giant prehistoric creature. It's shambling through the forest. Maybe it's something it attacked it. It got into a fight or it just ripped itself on some thorns,
mm-hmm.
but it's got this bleeding hole. So what happens to a bleeding hole on an animal? Insects come for it, right? Things start laying their squirming larvae in there. And so a bat might come and say, well, hey, I want to hang out where all these delicious insects are hanging out. And then they end up inevitably drinking from that font as well.
Which, again, is kind of too easy of a walk here.
Yeah. Shute, in his book, counters. He says that this scenario requires large wound sites on a regular basis. And also, as we're going to get into a little later, vertebrate blood is water and protein. There's no fat. So vampire bats can't store it as fat, like non-blood-drinking bats store away their food. They need to feed and consume 50% of their body weight in blood each night. So you need to be able to find, if you're depending upon wounds surrounded by insects, you got to be able to find those wounds surrounded by insects on a regular basis. And also, echolocation is going to be useless in finding these animals. It's just, there are a number of holes in this argument as well.
Now, the third hypothesis here is something called the arboreal feeding hypothesis, and it really focuses on carnivorous members of the neotropical bat family, Philistomidae, found in South America, where formerly there had been vast forests, which were then replaced by grasslands. So what does that mean? That means that all of a sudden you have very small little islands of forest mm-hmm. area. and you have a lot of big mammals taking refuge in these trees, sleeping in them at night. And so all of a sudden you've got a population of one tree that might be hosting many different hosts, as opposed to being spread out through the forest. And this is an opportunity for vampire bats. So what you're talking about here is a bunch of animals, like a sloth, taking refuge in these trees, falling asleep, and then these vampire bats, who are so stealthy, by the way, sneaking up and just saying, well, you don't mind if I do, and taking their blood samples there. And then, of course, this would encourage that behavior over and again as an adaptation in this scenario, because if you've got that loss of habitat and all of a sudden you've got these mammals congregated in the trees, well, that makes easy pickings.
So which hypothesis is true? Well, the answer is still open to debate. It's possible, as with a lot of things, it's more of a combination of these ideas as opposed to one distinct idea. And we have to remember that it's difficult to avoid falling into the trap of thinking of evolution as this clockwork predictable scenario. Again, if it's X here, then it's X there. If we turn back the clock and did it again, everything would come back to the same place, that we get the same results, and that's likely not how it goes. For whatever reason, a single group of New World leaf-nosed bats evolved as the only vertebrate obligate sanguivores, and it's pretty amazing.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk more about the hard knock life and bloodletting.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Let's talk about these vampire bats, because if you made it this far into vampire bat territory, you're about to get this serious blood payoff, because this is fascinating stuff. And maybe we should start this section as, like, you imagine you are the vampire bat, dear listener.
Imagine that you have sort of gone down this almost evolution. I wouldn't almost say an evolutionary dead end, but you've gone down far enough that you're in this very niche area, and there's no turning back. It's like that line in Macbeth where Shakespeare says, you know, I've waded, the main character says, I've waded through blood so far that if I were to turn back, it would be just as much work to keep going. And that's where the vampire bat is.
Yeah.
It's a hard knock life that the vampire bat has evolved into, but there's no turning back, at least not anytime soon.
That's right. So you are stuck with this blood diet. And the bad news here is, again, we've talked about it before, blood just doesn't have much to it in terms of nutrients. In fact, 80% of it is water. So what do you have to do? Every night, you must go out and hunt and lap up 50% of your body weight. And this is a hard thing to do, because you can't store any fat that it might have, because it doesn't have any fat. So you, every night, are obligated to go out.
Yeah, you can't sleep it off. You can't hibernate. You can't build up stores for later. There's no preparing for the winter. If winter comes, you're gone if you can't get blood. So, and that's why we see these three species of vampire bats living in tropical areas. They cannot knack it in areas that have cold climates.
So that's right. You cannot hack the cold weather. You have to take advantage of these areas that have warmer weather. And you must be really wily. So it's not just like, hey, I got to go out and get some blood. No, you're going to be the best at getting blood as any blood-getting mammal is going to get.
Yeah, you've got to use your stealth to the highest degree, because you need to prey on sleeping animals. You need to not wake them up while you're drinking their blood. And you can't exert a tremendous amount of effort and energy finding your prey, because again, you're on a very tight budget here. You have to eat every night, and you can't spend too much energy because you can't store that much energy. So you can't go on long drawn out hunts covering, you know, vast miles of area. You have to really hone in. You got to make it work, and you've got to get to feeding.
That's right. And so as a result, you have this exquisitely sensitive heat detecting molecule covering nerve ending on your nose, and this allows you to detect infrared heat that is just beaming from areas on a livestock's body. And that's sort of like the area that you know you're going to hone in on. Because as you said, you don't have tons of energy here. You got to be fast.
Yeah, you got to go right for the vein. There's no just crawling around on its rump until you find an area that's right. You can't feel it out. You got to see it. You got to focus in on it. And luckily, the vampire bat can do just that.
Yeah, and these guys, they mostly attack from ground, though sometimes it's from the trees. But they can actually run. It's only like 2.5 miles per hour or something, but still, that's pretty fast. And they think the reason for that, researchers think, is because if they're around something like a horse or a cow, it's easy to get trampled upon. So you got to get out of there fast. You got to be able to hop away. But it's pretty amazing to see them running.
All right. So you land next to the cow. You hit the ground running, more or less, and you scamper up there, right to the place, that hot spot that you've seen with your fantastic heat vision. And this is where you're going to feed. What do you do? Well, first thing you do is you lick that area. where you're going to apply the incision.
Ah, the saliva. Yeah. Anticoagulants.
Yes, because the saliva here is key and is really amazing. To quote Bill Shute from his book Dark Banquet, the process actually consists of a maddening cascade of chemical reactions that must occur before a clot forms. Because, again, when you make your incision now with your sharp teeth,
mm-hmm.
you're making a very small wound. You're not just, you know, you're not making this enormous font from which to drink. You're making something that, given its own devices, given the body's own defenses, this would normally close up in a couple of minutes. This is not,
right.
You're not just, you know, opening a jugular here and dancing around the fountain. You're creating a small wound, but anticoagulants in the blood prevent it from clotting, allowing you to feed there for the amount of time necessary to get that full meal.
Yeah, in this case, about 20, 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about their incisors, they are knife sharp. In fact, Bruce Patterson, a zoologist at Field Museum in Chicago, says you can actually cut yourself handling a bat skull in a museum.
Wow.
They're that sharp. Because, again, we're talking about efficiency here, getting in and getting in quick. And their tongues also get into the game here because they contain a specialized groove that allows a blood meal to flow via capillary action. So they do not suck. They slurp. They lap
yes.
up.
Which is another thing to keep in mind because, again, it's a small wound that's not going to be held open by suction. And to your point about the teeth, that's another aspect of this, too, is that it's such a small cut and it's made with such a sharp knife. You'd barely feel it while you're sleeping.
In his book, Bill Shute talks about an encounter with a bat and a hen that had him reeling. And I love this. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
So I was thinking about this. Not only does the bat have data from the infrared molecule and data from the breathing pattern of the livestock, but it also has been observing it and perhaps taking those observations and passing them down among its young and so on and so forth. And what I mean is that Bill Shute saw this bat sidle up to a hen, thought the hen was going to be like, no way, get away.
Mm-hmm.
But it did not, because the bat then went and cuddled up to the hen right at this area. It's called, I think it's called the brood patch. It's where chicks will go because there's more heat and more capillaries that are congregated there. So there's more heat available. So essentially, this bat is mimicking a chick and cozying up with the hen. And what he said is that he saw the hen like visibly look to be relaxed and then settle down.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bat kind of burrowed down a little bit more. And a couple minutes later, he saw evidence of that blood from underneath the hen where that bat had been suckling at the vein.
Oh, wow.
I think it's amazing
yeah.
that it essentially said, hello, hen. I know I look like a bat, but really I'm a sweet little chick who just needs a little warmth.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the tongue earlier, and the tongue is also really key here. Again, the bat is not sucking the blood. It's lapping the blood. But lapping, it's easy to just say, oh, lapping, and just sort of have this loose idea in your mind of a dog or a cat lapping milk or water, which even that, incidentally, if you slow it down and look at the video, is a far more complicated process than we you know, give it credit. With the bat, you have this piston-like motion of the tongue, and it causes the blood to flow along a pair of grooves on the bottom of the tongue and into the mouth through that cleft in the lower lip that mm-hmm. we mentioned earlier. So you have to imagine that, again, it's like this piston action of the tongue, just and you get this flow going out of the wound into the bat's mouth.
Yeah, we're talking about a tablespoon when it's all done. But, again, that's half of the bat's body weight. So after it leaves the tongue, it goes into the esophagus and down into the stomach, which is richly lined with blood vessels that absorb that water. And that shunts it straight to the kidneys before it actually goes to the intestines. So the stomach thing is really important here because it is absorbing all of that water. But the reason is because they have to work fast, these bats, in terms of digesting and expelling this stuff from their systems.
Yeah, again, they're loading up on blood, and they have to be ready to escape at a moment's notice. You know, that cow might wake up. At any time. And you're going to have to get away. You're going to have to then fly away. And you cannot be weighted down with all of this water weight. Because, again, we're talking about just consuming, you know, half your body weight in food. And you're going to have that stomach just filled with water. So you've got to get rid of it. And that's why you have this rapid removal of the water, shunt it through the kidneys. And then the vampire bat is urinating as it's feeding. Like, shortly after it starts feeding, mm-hmm. it starts urinating. Because it has to prepare for takeoff.
Yeah, to add insult to injury here. And it avoids soiling itself by extending one hind limb sideways and downward. So it's like, oh, I'm not going to get any on me, but hey, you, sorry about that.
Yeah, and it's also an interesting scenario when you start thinking about the urine itself. The urine that the bat is pumping out is getting increasingly concentrated as it goes, because part of the whole deal with our urine, of course, is we're getting rid of these the toxic aspects of our meal, and that's what the bat is doing as well. But it's doing in such a fast process at play here that you just have the concentration of the urine is just building up and building up the more that it urinates. And you get into this interesting area here too, where despite the fact that the vampire bat has this 100% liquid diet. And despite the fact that it lives in the tropics exclusively, it lives in its own kind of personal physiological desert. There's always this risk of dehydration because it has to get rid of so much of the water that it consumes through its meals.
Right.
That again factors into the economy of the vampire bat. It can't live in a place where there's any kind of dryness because it's living with such a slim margin. Between its life and complete dehydration.
Yeah, that's a really complex balancing game there.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks again to this idea, or at least in my head, that they almost feel like they're cursed in a sense. Like, and of course I'm evoking vampire lore here, but you know, you can't hibernate. You have to live in this very specific area. And night after night you must go out and kill. Well, not the kill part, but blood.
One thing it makes me think about, you've done freelance work, of course, freelance writing.
Yes.
And I have as well. And at times you like myself, you've thought to yourself, well, could I just depend solely on freelance writing?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you end up getting into this sort of vampire bat situation where you're like, yes, if I get enough gigs on a regular basis mm-hmm. in the just the right environment mm-hmm. and I never sleep, never hibernate, then I can make it work. I can just barely make it work and I can survive. And pay all my bills.
And then you end up just defecating and urinating on yourself all the time to avoid having to deal with any loss of energy, right?
Right.
And you're always looking for that next kill, that next job.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. It's kind of, I like that analogy.
Yeah. The vampire bat is living on the margins here. You know, it's found this niche, but it is a hard niche to exist in.
Indeed it is.
I want to point out that we do have a few fossil vampire bats, including the biggest vampire bat that ever existed, as far as we can tell from the fossil record, and that's the 30% larger Desmodus dracula, which is of course a great name for a vampire bat or some sort of a gothic band, and they were total vampires. They were not any kind of transitional form, and they existed farther up into the Americas. But the idea is this larger bat is depending on the blood of larger species.
Okay.
And as those species died out in prehistoric times, so did this. And so the domain of the vampire bat was once larger and contained more species, but mm-hmm. then it shrinks. And it's confined to these hot tropical zones and the few animals that they can still prey on for blood.
Ah, but what of global warming, which is actually warming up many parts of the world? And this has led some people to say, hey, we think that there is going to be an increase in the vampire bat population, specifically in North America, in Texas, and some parts of Louisiana in the next couple of decades.
So they might be coming.
To a city near you.
To a city near you, yes.
All right, so we've given you guys a description of these bats, but if you would like to see them specifically on a vamp cam, you can at this very moment. In fact, there's a camera in there 24 hours a day. You can observe these. And this is at the Organization for Bat Conservation. So that's batconservation.org.
Yeah, I was looking at it the other day, and they're really adorable, where they're scurrying around. That's the thing about the vampire bat. It's like part of us responds to them, and there's something kind of cute about them. But then there's also something that the very depth of our genes, we can't help but find repugnant. They walk that line.
Well, the distance, though, of the vamp cam makes it all sorts of adorable, right? You're like, my hand's not in that cage with them.
Right.
So that's so cute that they're cuddling right now.
And it's not full color either, so yeah. It's got that going for it.
Yeah.
So there you go. The vampire bat, the evolution of the vampire bat, the physiology of the vampire bat. I hope it allows everyone to have even more respect for these amazing creatures and just rethink the vampire equation in general. Like, it really made me rethink our ideas of a vampiric human and what that would be like. I feel like we focus far too much on the supernatural aspects of a humanoid vampire. We focus on the viral aspects of like vampirism as a disease in these fantasy scenarios. And of course we end up fantasizing and focusing on like the sexy and alluring aspect of some sort of a fictional vampire. Whereas if we look to the biological example, if we look to the vampire bat, it paints an mostly entirely different idea about what a vampiric human would look like. I think the closest we've come is the Nosferatu of the classic film and some of the rehashes we've seen.
Which is kind of like this withered figure, not this robust character wearing shades and a leather jacket and like ruling the night.
No, because even the vampire bat does not rule the night. It knows it does. I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing here. It knows it doesn't rule the night. It has to stick to the shadows. It has to conserve its energy, and it has to get the easiest, most filling meal it can. So the idea of this slim, ghastly corpse-like Nosferatu, reeling in the shadows, like that's I feel like
it's
that's the closest that we've managed to get.
I agree. I wish that Jim Jarmusch's new movie, Only Lovers Left Alive, would have explored that idea, which you explore in a blog post, by the way. Your Monsters of the Week.
I did a Monster of the Week on this idea.
So check that out if you want to kind of do some reimagining of Dracula in popular lore.
Yeah, I do want to see Only Lovers Left Alive. I didn't think that I would want to see another vampire film, but that one looks pretty good.
Tilda Swinton, the magical unicorn of a human, is in it, so I have to see it just for that alone.
Yeah, I want to see that. I also want to see Neil Jordan's Byzantium, which sounds interesting. Like, on the surface, it sounds like just another scenario of, like, two vampires, like a mother and a daughter vampire, and they're, trying to find their way in a world of vampires and living in the shadows. But it's like
misunderstanding each other.
Yeah. But it's
their mother daughter.
But it sounds more interesting because it's like strong, it's supposedly strong female characters based on a play by a female playwright.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about that I want to give that one a shot as well.
All right.
So what about you guys and gals out there? What do you think about the science of the vampire bat, the physiology and evolution of the vampire bat? How does that make you rethink these curious creatures? How does it make you rethink the myth of the vampire as it exists in folklore and in popular culture? We'd love to hear from you, and you can find us at all the normal places. There is, of course, stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That should be your first stop when you think to yourself, I wonder what those guys are up to. Well, go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll get the full dosage of all of our activities, including our blog posts, our podcasts, our videos, links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Google+, our YouTube account, which is Mind Stuff Show. If you haven't followed us there, if you're a regular YouTube user, go there and give us a follow. Listen, check out some of our videos there. We have a number of cool new projects that we're pushing out in the weeks ahead.
Indeed. And if you would like to get in touch with us in the meantime, you may do so at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.